Right, kia ora, hello and welcome to today's Weber Training Teleclass Lecture. My name is Jane Barnett and it gives me great pleasure to once again introduce a Weber Training South Pacific Teleclass Series. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker today, Professor Tom Riley, speaking to us from across the ditch there in Perth, Western Australia. Tom certainly has an impressive credentials. He's currently the Professor in Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Western Australia and also Principal Research Scientist in the Division of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases at the Queen Elizabeth II Medical Centre, as well as being a member of a number of Microbiology and Infectious Disease Societies internationally. He's also an editorial board member of the Journal of Antimicrobial Chemotherapy and Australian Infection Control Journal, and editor of reviews in medical microbiology. Tom's research interests are diverse. He's become well known for his work on the diagnosis and pathogenesis of Clostridium difficile, as well as infections with MRSA. It's his work related to the antimicrobial activity of tea tree oil and Staph aureus that he's kindly agreed to speak to us today. Welcome, Tom. Thank you very much for agreeing to be one of our 2009 Weber Training Teleclass speakers on the subject of tea tree oil and Staph sepsis.
Thanks, Jane. Pleasure to be here. I'm assuming everybody can hear me okay, so we'll just press on. I'm going to talk about eventually tea tree oil and some of its potential applications against staphylococci. I thought we should perhaps start with a bit more of a general introduction to the area of alternative antimicrobials. And if we go to the first slide, which has got that nice coloured circle, so we're all orientated correctly, the reason that we're interested in looking at alternative antibiotics is because of this public health dilemma we have worldwide of increasing antimicrobial resistance. And what it means is you get into this vicious circle of more antibiotic being required, more side effects, more cost, more resistance, and it just goes on and on and on. And MRSA have emerged because of the overuse of antibiotics, probably cephalosporins in the 1980s. Clostridium difficile has emerged, probably with the same sort of antibiotics driving them as in cephalosporins. VRE, also probably driven by cephalosporins. I do have a slide which I won't show, which says that cephalosporins are the work of the devil sent to end the antibiotic era. But that's basically true. Cephalosporins have got a lot to answer for, and we should be trying to move away from cephalosporins and overuse of antibiotics in general. But because we've got this problem, everybody's interested in looking at alternative ways of dealing with therapy of infectious diseases, and it's made people go back and look at some of the things that were happening before the antibiotic era and which have kind of slipped off the page for now. So if we go to the next slide, which lists a number of different alternative approaches to antimicrobial agents. We have a list there. We have naturally occurring antimicrobial agents called phytomedicines by some. And this is a huge industry worldwide, and there are a number of possible naturally occurring antimicrobials that I've listed there, from medicinal plants, essential oils, which is clearly where tea tree oil fits in. I'm just going to mention briefly the other two, garlic and honey, in a second. But there's also bacteriophage therapy. So these are viruses that have specific activity against bacteria. We're all the rage in the Soviet, former Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s. And in fact, up until quite recently, the fall of the Soviet Empire, there was a phage research institute at in Tbilisi in Georgia. A lot of those scientists have actually moved to the United States now and work for a variety of different startup companies looking at ways of using bacteriophages as antimicrobial agents. And then the last thing that I'm interested in is probiotic therapy, which is giving live microbial food supplements that have some sort of beneficial effect on the host, either in terms of preventing infectious diseases or, for example, in the case of Clostridium difficile, treating recurrent cases. And we actually use Saccharomyces boulardii to treat all our recurrent cases of C. difficile diarrhea. So we go to the next slide, which has a list of some naturally occurring antimicrobials. On the left are the ones that you see lots: garlic, Qinghao Su, which is a Chinese anti-malarial, cranberry juice. Remembering, of course, that it's the American cranberry, not the European cranberry. Two different species have completely different activities. Honey and tea tree oil. And on the right, I've just listed three or four Australian plants that our indigenous people use, and you can tell really, certainly for the first one, dysentery bush, you can tell what it's used for just by looking at its name. So there's a lot of stuff out there, and we probably need to be doing more research into looking at looking for antimicrobials in plants. Now, clearly, this is not a novel concept. I mean, 30% of the chemotherapeutic agents we use today actually come from plants. And so the idea of looking for antimicrobials in plants is not all that astounding. It's just that people don't seem to want to do it or spend the money on it. So if you go to the next slide, medicinal plants, there's lots of applications for antimicrobial activity of plant extracts. In food preservation, and things have been used. Oregano, for example, has been used for a long time. Pharmaceuticals and alternative medicines. You might be interested to know that there's more than 2,500 plants that have something in them that's active against Staph aureus and MRSA. Towards the end, I'll get to some of the problems why these compounds haven't really been taken up. But berberine, for example, naturally occurring in a number of different plants, has very low MICs against Staph aureus, in the order of 25 micrograms per mil. So we're looking here at plants that contain constituents that really are active in the sort of concentrations that more conventional antimicrobials are active in. So if we go to the next slide, there's an example. There's St. John's wort, which is one of those things that people have been using for many years for a variety of different things, generally used for treating skin infections, skin or wound infections. We know that there's an active component in there, which is hyperforin, but I've just alluded to some of the issues when we start talking about alternative agents, that there needs to be a lot more work done in terms of safety of the individual agents, and B, that there's a real concern about interactions of alternative agents with conventional medications. So there's clearly a lot more work needs to be done in this area. Garlic, if we look at the next slide, which is just a picture of a few garlic cloves, and moving on to the next slide, garlic's been used, for example, since 3000 BC by the Sumerians. The Sumerians, if you don't know the Sumerians, that's the group of people who used to live at the junction of the Tigris and the Euphrates River rivers in present-day Iraq, which is the group that Saddam Hussein tried. They live on the reeds in the rivers. Saddam Hussein tried to bomb out of existence at one stage. So this is something, garlic's been used for a long time, used by Egyptians, Romans, Greeks. First evidence as an antimicrobial was by the French, and we're not quite sure whether they were cooking with it or whether they probably were cooking with it at the same time. But wine and a mixture of wine and garlic, which sounds like something you might like to put your piece of steak in before you cooked it, also has quite good potent antimicrobial activity. A lot of those stories, of course, are anecdotal stories, but if you look at garlic, so if you go to the next slide, garlic has antimicrobial properties which are attributed to a compound called allicin, which is produced from alanine via an enzyme, alanase. And when you crush garlic, it releases this enzyme and the conversion process takes place. And what you end up getting is a lot of dialol and tri- and tetraalol sulfides, which are also very active at microgram amounts. So they have activity against gram-positives, particularly MRSA, also gram-negatives, and fungi. If you've got a ringworm, an epidermophyton or trichophyton infection on your skin, you get a clove of garlic and crush it and just rub it on the ringworm, it will go away. And you may smell kind of strong and garlicky, but you won't get attacked by vampires either. So there are some certain advantages to using garlic. If we go to the next slide, some more specific anti-MRSA activity. This paper published in the Journal of Antimicrobial Therapy a few years back, showing that patients that have eaten garlic have actually got anti-MRSA activity in their serum. And these Japanese workers tested this in a mouse model of MRSA infection, where they infected these mice, treated them with garlic extract or with purified dialyl and trialyl sulfides. And if they used too high concentrations, they actually killed the mice. But if they got the right concentration, the growth of MRSA was inhibited in a dose-dependent fashion. So there's clearly a lot of work needs to be done, but there's some very good signs that there are good anti-MRSA and anti-staphylococcal compounds coming out of garlic. So if we move to the next slide, just very briefly, a little bit about honey, of course. Honey is very popular in New Zealand. They have a particular type of honey there, which I'm sure many of you already know about, called Manuka honey from this is where it gets a little bit confusing, the New Zealand tea tree, which is completely different animal to the Australian tea tree, which we're going to get onto in a few seconds. The New Zealand tea tree is Leptospermum scoparium, and again, honey in general, and specifically Manuka honey, has a long history of use, very wide-ranging antibacterial activity against a whole heap of different organisms, staphs, including MRSA, and I've listed them there, E. coli, Pseudomonases. The great debate is, which has been raging now for many years, is why is honey antimicrobial? Initially, it was thought that it was because of the high osmolarity of this honey, because if you remove water from organisms, they will die. But it's more than that. It's the high osmolarity, the low pH. The best honeys for killing bugs contain peroxide. But there's also something else, and there's a little bit of debate at the moment. The New Zealanders call this unique Manuka factor, but if you're a New Zealander, you think that New Zealand honey is better than anything else, and maybe it is. In Australia, we think that we have some honeys that work just as well. But there's clearly a lot of interest in honey in wound care, and on the next slide, you'll see a picture of the particular Leptospermum species from which these honeys are derived. And on the slide after, it's always the single case report that really sticks in your mind. And when I saw these photos, I couldn't help but take notice. So this is a patient who had some diabetic foot ulcers, had been treated with multiple antibiotics for over a year, cost a lot of money. He had MRSA, VRE, Pseudomonas. Eventually, his vascular surgeon said, "I have to take your foot off." And he said, "No, I'm going to treat myself." And these are the results of his treatment with honey poultices over a period, admittedly, of 12 months. But you can see there how his foot has actually recovered. He's minus a few toes, but at least he's still got his foot. So a very good example of what can be done with some of these alternative agents. So if we go to the next slide, we'll turn up what I call Tea Tree Road. Now this is Gingin's actually a small town just out from Perth in Western Australia. But of course, tea tree oil in Australia is not produced in Western Australia. And if we go to the next slide, which is a map of Australia, tea tree oil comes from the plant Melaleuca alternifolia, and it grows naturally only between, probably if you look see where Brisbane is on the east coast, just south of Brisbane to about halfway down between Brisbane and Sydney. That's the only place in the world, that thin coastal strip there, where Melaleuca alternifolia grows naturally. grows in the bush. And in the old days, people used to go out in the bush and cut down trees and distill oil from trees that were growing naturally. There is actually a group of plantations up in Queensland, in North Queensland, where that where it says Great Dividing Range on this slide, just inland from Cairns, that's Cairns on the coast, a whole bunch of tobacco growers, when smoking became less fashionable, they pulled out their tobacco plants and have planted Melaleuca alternifolia and are now producing tea tree oil up there. Completely different, they actually get two crops per year versus only one down south. But they do have to irrigate up there. There's no irrigation of tea tree grown just south of Brisbane. And the guys in Cairns have a few problems with fungal infections of the plant's roots, interestingly enough. So if we go to the next slide, and this is a picture of an Australian Aboriginal. Tea tree oil has always been thought of as an Aboriginal remedy. And the Bundjong tribe, which is the tribe of Aboriginals that was live just south of Brisbane in that area where the plants grow, they tell in their oral history of the use of tea tree oil. Now, clearly, it didn't come to them in a bottle as this gentleman is holding. This is obviously what we have these days, but in former times, probably what they talked about was actually healing lakes. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see on the left is a flowering Melaleuca alternifolia plant, and you can differentiate it from a very closely related species called Melaleuca lineifolia by looking at how those little spikes come out. They come out alternately, which is why it's got its name. And on the right-hand side, you can see a young lady standing in one of these so-called healing lakes. And the idea was that tea tree leaves fell into these lakes. The leaves contain these little sacks of oil. Now, some of the oil components, as we'll see in a minute, are actually very slightly soluble in water. And so there's likely to be some oil, very small quantities of oil, dissolved in the water. But having a look at the colour of these lakes, you can see they're quite brown. And in fact, it's much more likely that it's tannins that come from some of these plants that are also responsible for some of the antimicrobial activity. But whatever it is, these lakes are called healing lakes. And the Aboriginal people talk of using these healing lakes to cure infections, skin type infections in the main. So if we go to the next slide, I'll just run you through how tea tree oil is produced in Australia these days. As I said, initially tea tree oil was produced from trees that were grown naturally out in the forest, but these days it's all plantation grown. And if you go to this next slide, you can see we're in the kind of the nursery. These are all tea tree plants, all being lined up. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see how they're planted out in these big rows, very much plantation style. And they grow for probably 18 months to 2 years, depending on how well they grow. They get to sort of a height of 4 or 5, 6 feet, and then they're harvested. And you can see there's a strip of unharvested trees, and you can see the harvested trees on the right. And if you look at the harvesting process a little bit more closely on the next slide, you can see these two tractors going along where the trees are basically just chopped off at the base. They're shredded and they go into that big green hopper. If we go to the next slide, you can see that a little bit more close up. And that hopper eventually goes, that basically forms part of the distillation process. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see what's left. And you can see there is just a tree stump. The really good thing about this industry and these trees, and probably most Australian plants actually, you can't kill them. So these trees will regrow in a matter of weeks. And in fact, they regrow much thicker. And so they regrow for a period of 18 months or so, and then they're harvested again. So we have this continual renewable source of tea tree oil. On the next slide, the distillation process is shown here. So you can see that big green hopper that all the tea tree leaves and branchlets have been chopped up into, and there's a red pipe leading into it. Well, that's steam. So this is a steam distillation process. So steam's driven in at the bottom of the hopper. It's got a lid on it now, of course. And at the top, that round cylindrical thing, which you can see on the left as well, is a water-cooled still. Simple steam distillation process. So water vapour and oil vapour go into the stills, water-cooled. You get condensation of the water and condensation of the oil, and the oil runs down those pipes. And if we go to the next slide, you can see that the oil and water go into these containers, and the clear glass container at the top contains the oil, because the oil is lighter than the water, so it sits on top of the water. And those big stainless steel containers at the bottom actually contain the water that's condensed, which has got a little bit of tea tree dissolved in it. So if we go to the next slide, you've got a close-up there. Same sort of principle, where you've got oil sitting on top of water. Looks a little bit yucky there, but it's all cleaned up by the time it gets into a nice stainless steel container. So next slide is the last one in the production process, if you like, and it just shows all this leftover stuff from the distillation process and these big heaps, and that all goes off to use as garden mulch. So it's very ecologically friendly industry. There's nothing wasted. It's all very renewable, and we think it's quite a good thing over here in Australia. So we go to the next slide. We can have a look at what is, in fact, tea tree, or what does it comprise? Well, it's this pale yellow viscous fluid. Has this very nice, to me anyway, nice smell. Smells a bit sort of, you know, pine foresty. One of the problems, but also one of the advantages of tea tree oil, is that it consists of at least 100 different components. And these components are mainly terpenes and sesquiterpenes and related alcohols. And they're the components that have antimicrobial activity. The levels of these different components does vary a little bit, although the Australian industry has been working very hard over the last 20 years to produce particular clones of tea tree plants that produce very rigid amounts of different components. But you do get a little bit of variation. There is an international standard that regulates the composition of tea tree oil, and that's that ISO 4730 standard, and it actually regulates the amounts of 14 of those 100 plus different components. So you know if you've got good tea tree oil versus not good tea tree oil, because there's a certain compositional standard that needs to meet before it can be called tea tree oil. Now, seven components actually make up 80 or 90% of the oil. And if we go to the next slide, you'll see seven major components, and that's the first seven listed there. Terpenein 4-ol has the most antimicrobial activity, and it makes up around about 35% of the oil. 1,8-cineol doesn't have any activity at all, and for a long time people thought that 1,8-cineol was an allergen and was responsible for some of these skin reactions that people, allergic responses that people get when they're exposed to tea tree oil. And subsequently it's been disproven. 1,8-cineol is not allergenic at all. But before that happened, the industry managed to breed it out. So you have to have less than 15% 1,8-cineol in proper pure tea tree oil. But in fact, most tea tree oil these days has about 3% 1,8-cineol. Those various other components have varying amounts of antimicrobial activity, gamma-terpenol, alpha-terpenein, gamma-terpenine, terpinolene, and paracimine is probably, it's an oxidation product of paracimine that is responsible for most of the allergic type reactions that you do see with tea tree oil. Probably in our experience, maybe 1% of individuals has a true allergy to tea tree oil, and that's not any of the components. It's actually an oxidation product of paracimine. So if you keep your tea tree oil in a closed container and you don't expose it to too much air and too much light, then you won't get any of these problems. And the only other component I've listed there is actually linalool, which is in a very small amount in tea tree oil. But if you take, for example, the broad-leafed tea tree, which is a completely different species, which is Melaleuca quinquinervia, and in the Pacific, for example, is known as Niuli, and grows all over the Pacific. It's a bit of a weed, actually. It's taking over the Everglades in Florida. The main component of the broadleaf tea tree is linalool. Completely different smell, completely different activity, but something which could also be investigated and is indeed used for medicinal use. So if you go to the next slide, I guess we come to the sort of crux of the issue. Can tea tree oil prevent MRSA? Does it have a role in either preventing or treating infections with staphylococci or MRSA? And I've just taken a quote from a paper published in the Medical Journal of Australia nearly 10 years ago now, where Anderson and Fennessy say, the experimental evidence supporting the use of tea tree oil as a prophylactic for MRSA is compelling. And basically, most of that experimental evidence is stuff that we've produced over a number of years now. We've been working with this since 1993, I think, and have probably published 30 to 40 papers looking at the in vitro activity of tea tree oil against a wide variety of different organisms. And I don't have time to give you all those papers. I'm just going to pick a few examples and then move on to some of the clinical studies that we've been involved in. So if we go to the next slide, which hopefully, if we haven't got out, I haven't got you out of order, we should have a slide with a big red boxes down below looking at the MICs and MBCs of tea tree oil against a range of different skin type organisms, either commensals or transient type flora, which is the ones that are sort of highlighted in red. So we've got a bunch of gram-negative enterics and Staph aureus. And you can see that the MIC 90s for the transient organisms is actually much lower than, so these are in percent, volume, so 0.25%, for example, for E. coli. These MIC 90s for the transient organisms are actually much lower than for the commensal organisms. And we kind of feel that in situations where we might be wanting to use tea tree oil as a skin wash, having this differential between transients and skin commensals, which we don't want to get rid of, is a good thing. We've been working with a number of manufacturers now to come up with a range of different tea tree oil hand wash products. And we've published two or three papers now in the Journal of Hospital Infection looking at how well these hand wash products do in various conventional sort of tests of hand washes and disinfectants, and they do very well. So if we go to the next slide, one of the issues that people raise all the time is, why won't we see, or will we see, resistance to tea tree oil develop if we're going to use it, in much the same way as resistance has developed for conventional antimicrobial agents. Again, we've been working now for nearly 20 years doing tea tree stuff, and we've never seen resistance develop. Our view is that the likelihood that this is going to happen is very low due to the nature of the compounds themselves. The fact that there are multiple mechanisms of action, the fact that the effects that we see with tea tree oil are a bit like disinfectants. They're gross effects. Many of them are non-specific effects affecting the cell membrane. And so putting all that together, we think that there's little likelihood that we'll see resistance developing to tea tree oil. So for those situations, topical type situations, where we might be able to use something against a multi-resistant organism, the idea of using an alternative agent like tea tree oil to us is very appealing. So if we go to the next slide now, which talks about formulation issues, it's not just a straightforward thing, formulating tea tree oil. And this is where a lot of the confusion has come into the field. Because it's an oil and you're mixing oils with waters, people like to put in surfactants to help the mixing process. And what we found over a number of years is that many surfactants and excipients that go into a lot of these preparations actually inactivate tea tree oil. So you end up getting what's called critical micelle formation, where the surfactant actually completely surrounds the tea tree oil molecules, and then they don't get a chance to act. And the things that we've found, for example, sodium lauryl sulfate, very commonly used surfactant in a lot of products, sorbolene, for example. There was a study done, a clinical trial of tea tree oil for the use of tinea, which was published in the MJA probably 13 or 14 years ago, where they had symptomatic relief, so they got a bit of relief from their itching, but they had no mycological cure. And then when you had a look at their product, you found that they'd formulated this tea tree oil in sorbolene cream. Well, it will have had absolutely no activity against fungi when it was bound up in sorbolene. So you really do need to test your final product to make sure that it actually works and does what you think it's going to do. And this is one of the problems with many of the products that are out there on the market, the sort of things that you get in health food shops. Those products have not been tested, and some of the formulations are a little bit dodgy. So I just warn you that there are some issues there which need to be sorted out. If we go to the next slide, I'll just talk about some of our in vivo stuff. And so this is a study where we looked at, this is our pilot study, to look at decolonisation of a couple of groups of patients with MRSA. And as it was a pilot study, we only had small numbers, so 30 patients, 15 in each group. And they were randomly allocated to receive either a 4% tea tree oil nasal ointment plus a 5% tea tree oil body wash versus 2% mupirocin and triclosan body wash. And then they were swabbed at 2 or 4 days post-treatment. And we used an intention-to-treat analysis. If we go to the next slide, and I've just picked out a couple of the salient features of this, the fact was this was clearly too small to have statistically significant differences, but we actually got better clearance in our tea tree regime versus the control regime. Now, we've repeated this on a much larger group of patients and got very similar results, that hasn't been published. So I thought if you have a look at the next slide, you can see Matthew Dryden's paper, which was published in the Journal of Hospital Infection about 5 years ago. And this is his decolonisation study, which was carried out in Winchester in the United Kingdom. On the left, you have what they call their standard therapy, which is mupirocin plus chlorhexidine plus silver sulfadiazine for any open wounds, chlorhexidine body wash, and versus tea tree oil. So this is a 10% tea tree cream, 5% tea tree body wash, and a 10% tea tree cream for any wounds. And if you go to the next slide, which is a nice burgundy slide, looking at the overall results of the Matthew Dryden study, you can see that overall there's actually not a huge amount of difference between the standard therapy in terms of who's MRSA negative and who's MRSA positive at the end of the study. The standard therapy did a little bit better overall, but statistically there's no difference between those figures there. Where you do start to see a statistically significant difference, though, is if you break up the sites where MRSA was found. And so if you have a look at the next slide, which is the clearance rates at different sites, and you can see that with the nose and throat, the mupirocin people did much better. So if you have a look at the nose, for example, 78% clearance with the mupirocin group versus 47% clearance with the tea tree group. So with the nose, the mupirocin did much better. But if you look at the other sites, the axilla, groin and wounds, so where your skin wash and antimicrobial cream, if you like, are being used, you can see that the tea tree group actually did much better than the chlorhexidine group. And so we were very enthused by these results because we got similar sorts of results when we did the same sort of study. I think there's a few issues with using chlorhexidine. My feeling is that a tea tree body wash is a much nicer thing for the patients. When we've done these studies, we've never had any complaints about tea tree body washes at all. And I think there's good data now, or starting to be good data, to suggest that there is really a role for this product in the decolonisation of MRSA. If we go to the next small study, which we've done, which is a study of impetigo, which we carried out in South Africa a few years ago. South Africa, impetigo, very similar to prevalence, is very similar to what we see in some of our Aboriginal kids. It's a problem that occurs in humid and sort of economically deprived areas, and certainly in Australia impetigo is a huge issue in the indigenous population because a lot of the indigenous people go on to have sort of sequelae of their impetigo, so sort of rheumatic heart disease, kidney problems, etc., etc. So this is a real issue, and we'd always thought that tea tree oil was probably a really good alternative agent to introduce to this population, given originally this is an Aboriginal treatment in the first place. So we did this study in South Africa, just a simple before-after type study at some kids at these two primary schools. Only 30 children, very standard. We're on the next slide now. Sorry, I didn't tell you to move to the next slide. But the one that says tea tree oil impetigo at the top. Simple study, standard definitions of impetigo, and if we go to the next slide, we can see that these lesions were quantified by a study nurse and qualified. We got parental consent for the intervention. What we tried to do was get these kids treated at school at least twice a day by their teacher, and then the third treatment was supposed to be at home for the parents, and we were a little concerned that the parents might not actually do it, but at least we know they got at least twice a day treatment for 7 days with 6% tea tree oil cream, and then we re-examined them at 7 days and 10 days, and anybody that failed ended up getting conventional therapy. When we looked at the swabs from these kids, we had 21 that grew Staph aureus and Strep pyogenes, 3 that grew Strep pyogenes and 3 that grew Staph aureus, and that's on the next slide. And if we go to the next slide, which says treatment results, you can see that the average pre-treatment lesion size was 15 millimetres. Nearly 60% were healed at 10 days. Of the remaining 13, 12 of them had lesions that were either decreased in size or equal in size, and the average was 10, so significantly smaller than the pre-treatment size. Only one lesion happened to be larger, and this was a patient who also had scabies, and we suspect that that had a significant impact on our ability to treat the staph in this case. So What we also did was take a second set of swabs from these patients who apparently hadn't completely cured, and we tested their organisms by pulse field gel electrophoresis. And so of the 10 staphs that we isolated from our repeat swabs, 5 were actually a completely different pulse field type. So this suggests that maybe these are kids that are getting reinfected and it wasn't just a failure of therapy. So again, overall, very good results suggesting that this might be something which needs to be explored a little bit further. So there have been a number of other studies that we've done. We've always had quite promising results, and I guess we've asked the question on the next slide, why haven't these treatment options been explored further? Seems to me that it's a reasonably logical thing to do. So if we go to the next slide, there's some reasons for why some of these alternative therapies in general, and specifically the tea tree type approach, haven't been taken up. Well, one of them is that big pharma don't see that there's anything that they can patent. And if they can't patent it, they figure they can't make money from it. So that's one barrier that we have to overcome. Many of the products that we see out there are produced by companies that really don't understand healthcare. They come from this, alternative lifestyle, maybe food, health food type shops, and they don't really understand healthcare. They don't understand all the rules and regulations in terms of getting products to a situation where they might be used in healthcare on a routine basis. So that's a bit of a problem. Because there's a lot of interest in alternative therapies at the moment, there's a lot of companies out there, small companies, that are trying to take advantage of that interest and sell their products without actually doing the background work. And so there are many companies making unsubstantiated claims. They don't have the data to back it up. Certainly in Australia, there's, up until quite recently, and probably still, has not been a good regulatory process in place for these sorts of agents. I think that's changing. We now have a section of our Therapeutic Goods Administration that deals with some of these therapies, but I'm not sure that they're particularly well resourced. We know that there are some very poor quality products out there, and unfortunately these are on the market because these are not registered therapeutic agents. They're licensed, so they're safe. But they don't have to show that they actually work, and that's a big problem. One of the reasons people don't go to the clinical trial situation is that, as you know, clinical trials are very expensive. And many of these companies, as I mentioned, are small companies. They don't have the resources to do these large clinical trials. And last, but certainly by no means least, with alternative therapies in general and specifically with some of the tea tree products, there are still some safety issues that need to be addressed. Products need to be made with good quality oil that has been stored in the way as I was talking about, so protected from light, protected from exposure to oxygen. So there's a lot of these sorts of issues which need to be sorted out before we're going to get to a stage where these things are going to be used regularly in healthcare. But I think, as the article in the Medical Journal of Australia said in 2000, the evidence, certainly the in vitro evidence, is overwhelming that many of these products, and particularly tea tree oil, can have a role to play in controlling particularly MRSA, which, as I'm sure you're aware, is not only a huge problem in hospitals now, but we have the movement of community MRSA around the world. I think if you're going to start looking at community MRSA and doing something in the community, then perhaps using traditional antimicrobials to deal with issues in the community is not the way to go, and that we really do need to be looking at some of these alternative approaches. If you go to the next and last slide, there is this view, I think, from the public that, I mean, the public has a favourable view of alternative therapies. They probably don't understand what alternative therapies are all about, but they view them as natural and they view them as safe, and certainly many of them are natural, but not all of them are safe, and these are issues that which we need to address. We need to get better information out there. Clearly there is a likelihood that they're going to have less side effects than some antibiotics, but we do have a problem relating to quality. We do have a problem relating to good data. I don't know how we're going to get that data without governments investing in the process of evaluating some of these agents. I think if patients are going to use them, and most surveys will tell you that 50 or 60% of the population actually have tried various alternative type therapies, if patients are going to use them, then we need to have the data to support or refute the use of these various agents. So we've taken the approach that with tea tree oil, we'll do the in vitro testing, we'll do it properly, we'll get lots of in vitro data, we'll then use that information to work with various companies to formulate products that we then also test, and we know that these products work, and then we go to the clinical trial situation. And there we're running into problems because, say, the expense of clinical trials is something that many of these companies can't afford. So I think somehow we need to involve government, and if anybody's got any bright ideas about involving government in these things, I'd be very happy to hear from them. And on that note, I'll stop. I think I'm sort of on time, aren't I, Jane?
You've run very well to time, actually, Tom, so thank you very much for that. I think that's a fascinating insight into some of the possibilities around tea tree, which many of us in infection control are very interested in. So thank you for that. And I knew that there must be some reason why the French like their wine and garlic so much. It's obviously the anti-plague approach centuries ago, which is very good to know. So in terms of its current production, I wasn't aware of the difference between New Zealand tea tree and Australian, but most of the current
big
product
difference
that's available is from Australia, presumably, is it?
Yes, but you'll get some interesting things happen. Australian tea tree oil has a much broader spectrum than New Zealand tea tree oil. And occasionally I get people ringing me up from or emailing me from around the world saying, I've tested this tea tree oil and it doesn't kill gram negatives. And I say to them, well, you're probably using New Zealand tea tree oil because New Zealand tea tree oil has reasonably specific gram positive and antifungal activity, but not much gram negative activity, whereas Australian tea tree oil has more broader activity. And there is a real difference, as I said, Australian Melaleuca, alternifolia, New Zealand tea tree oil, Leptospermum and Scopularium. So you need to make sure you know where your tea tree oil is coming from.
It seems like a real opportunity for future development by companies, doesn't it, if you can get that governmental interest and support as we go forward with MDROs. It's likely to happen, do you think?
Well, look, I think it's inevitable, but I mean, I've been saying that now for, gosh, the last 10 years. The evidence is pretty good that these things do work. I know that there are a lot of people, particularly in relation to MRSA, of course, which is the real big issue. There are a lot of people around the world now doing little bits of tea tree stuff. I know many aged care facilities, for example, that just routinely use tea tree oil products, and this is in the United States, to try and deal with their MRSA product problem. The difficulty is that we still don't have those published clinical trials. There's been, well, ours, which we've just finished writing up, which we're about to send off. There's the Matthew Dryden paper. There's our couple of pilot studies, and that's it. And we really need more data, I think, just to better inform people.
So as an option in Western Australia, do you ever refer patients to use this, the problem patients that you haven't been able to clear?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're doing it on a sort of patient-by-patient basis, but I do actually get individual patients ringing me up saying, what can I try, because I've got all these recurrent boils. And so we give them tea tree body wash. And that works. I mean, a lot of people don't actually like using chlorhexidine. It does funny things to your skin, I'm afraid. Yes, it is. But the tea tree is nice. You know, it's not, doesn't dry your skin out. We've trialled it, some hand washes up in our intensive care unit, and the staff up there have commented very positively. In fact, we had a Bachelor of Medical Science student spend a whole year working on a trial in our intensive care unit, and that went very well.
That's fascinating. So, well, thank you very much, Tom, for that insight. In closing, I'd like to thank Tom Riley very much for his great contribution to this year's teleclass series. I hope, Tom, that maybe we can possibly interest you in contributing to the next year's series as well. You've obviously got a lot of work that we could possibly tap into. So thank you very much.
Love to talk about C. difficile at some stage.
That would be excellent. Thank you. That's always high on our priorities as well. So
no, it should be. The world's most important organism.
Yes, we're waiting for it to hit here, and then maybe it'll create even more interest as we get the pathogenic strain. So, but thank you very much to your contribution. That's great. And thank you to you for listening in as well. I hope that you're able to join us for more of the South Pacific teleclass series. But don't forget, as an audience as well, you can also listen to any of the Weber teleclass series by registering on the website and either listening to them live, or if the time zone doesn't suit, just listen to them on rebroadcast or recording. Many thanks for listening in today, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future. Thank you. Bye-bye.